Good afternoon. Before I forget it, today, before you leave, pick up your gift copy of Mystical Eye at the desk here. We have an interesting subject today. Although it's about a man walking on water, it has a great deal of meaning to us now that we have come to the place of identity, where we are ready to stand on identity, looking out at the world regardless of what it presents, and knowing that identity is invincible, without opposite, without a need to protect itself, ever present, ever functioning, ever perfect, needing no help whatsoever to defend itself, to improve itself, to correct itself, for it is all that is here. Once we have, to a degree, made this our starting point, walking on the water becomes a very significant event. Religiously, we only say, he walked upon the water. And there it stops. It does no good for mankind whatsoever. Scientifically, we say, he didn't walk upon the water because it's impossible. And so either way, whether you happen to be religious and say he did, or scientific and say he did not, you're stuck with an event that has no significance in your life. And it would be ridiculous to assume that the way shower would be functioning in such an abnormal event without a purpose. Now, it is then insufficient for us to believe he did or didn't, but rather to know why that took place. We're given several clues, and even the Gospel of Matthew misses the major clue. While it reports the event, it does not report something significant which John caught. And so we have to compare the same event in two Gospels. We find in Matthew, it goes this way. Straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship, to go before him unto the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. They had all just been fed, 5,000 of them, with invisible loaves and fishes. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. Now the significant thing here is that after this seemingly supernatural event, why did he go into a mountain to pray? You know that prayer is the activity of consciousness in oneness with God. And you know that in order for loaves and fishes to appear to feed the multitudes, he had to be in that kind of prayer. And therefore, having been in prayer, having produced through prayer the visible requirement of the moment, why would he now retire to a mountain to pray? Now, this is not given in Matthew. In a moment, you see the ship is in the midst of the sea tossed with the waves, and so he skips right from Jesus going to the mountain to pray to a ship tossed on the sea, and to even a very studious reader, there's no indication here of why, after the Master feeds the multitudes with loaves and fishes, he should retire to a mountain to pray. But we're given this instantly in John. And because it is so different, I would like to do the John version of it. Now in John, after they have gathered their baskets and eaten, and then the men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, "This is of a truth, that prophet that should come into the world." Now this is where John differs from Matthew. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Now the significance there is that he had perceived that they were personalizing him. They were seeing Jesus, a man, a Messiah, one who could feed multitudes. This was the man who would free the Jews. And this was dangerous, because this was not his mission. His mission was to present the universal Christ as the substance, the identity, the law, the activity of every person on the earth. Here, a segment of the world, seeing his miracles, was ready to crown him king, a person, a man, with supernatural powers. And so he had a problem. What was he going to do about it? How could he make known to them the truth that he was not a man, that he was the light, that the light of his being was the light of their being, that they were one and the same, and that all that he did, they could do? And so he went to a mountain to pray. Just as you and I, confronted with an insurmountable obstacle, will sit in the silence, standing still, waiting for that inner self to emerge and take dominion. He had reached the point where doing miracles was not enough. He had to reveal to them the source of every miracle. That the source was the infinite self, which was the self of all. That he was not one selected alone. That the Messiah indwelt every individual. And he needed guidance. And it was in this moment, while he, in deep silence, waiting for the voice, was confronted by another situation. And yet this very situation was the answer to the guidance he sought. The ship on the sea was in trouble. And it was miles away. There was no time now to catch another ship. There was no time now to be that man which the world saw as Jesus. He had to be miles away now. For his disciples were on the ocean. They were on that lake out there, and it was an ocean to them. They were fishermen. They were skilled in all of the maneuvers on the lake. They made their livelihood there, and here, in spite of it, they were in trouble. They were rowing frantically, and the turbulence was upon them, and they needed help. And this was the answer to that which he was meditating upon. What shall he do to show the source is not the man, but the spirit which is the substance of all men? And now he had to be somewhere else now. He had to be spirit in action. And so they saw him walking upon the water. And they were surprised, undecided, frightened. Surely this was a myth, some kind of an hallucination. They didn't recognize him in the slightest. Even when he got on board, they didn't recognize him. It doesn't even say here that he got his feet wet. They saw this apparition walking on the water. And religion says it really happened, period. It happened. Now you try to go out and cash that at the bank. You try to use that to make yourself feel better. You try to do something with the fact that it really happened. See if that'll keep an atom bomb away from our country or away from this world. Unless we see what happened when they saw that apparition walking on the water. And so we're staying with John on this instead of Matthew, because John gives us the reason that the event took place. It was a response to an inner need for guidance to show the world that Jesus was not a miracle maker, but that the Spirit of God had answered every need before the need arose. And always where there was one in consciousness, receptive, yielding, humble, trusting, confident, one who had stepped out of mortal identity, the answer would flow not just as a casual suggestion, but as an activity in consciousness. And here that activity manifested as the disciples frantically rowing on a turbulent sea, needing help. And there was no man who could give them help for such a situation, only Spirit itself. The disciples then entered the ship, went over the sea toward Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. There's a symbolism in dark. Day is always the spiritual journey, and night is always the material journey. For them, it was night. We know it was the fourth watch. We know that there are four watches beginning at 6 p.m., 3 hours apiece. And so this was between 3 and 6 a.m. Actually, it was before sunrise. And that again has a symbolism. Just as the sun falls in the west, which is death, and rises again in the east, which is resurrection. So they were in the darkness just before dawn. And now we're preparing for a resurrection, for a sun coming up, for light, to take them out of darkness. The sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So when they had rowed about 25 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea, drawing nigh unto the ship, and they were afraid. But he saith unto them, It is I, be not afraid. Then they willingly received him into the ship, and immediately, the ship was on the land whither they went. The instant he stepped on the ship, it was no longer in the sea, it was on the shore. So we have some fantastic things happening there in response to the inner prayer, to shatter all material concepts. Now, there are many levels to walking on the water, and if we can take an in-depth study, I believe we can come up with much that will be of advantage to us in the days of revelation that lie ahead of all of us. For one, I think you may find that this event coupled with all other events in the complete demonstration by Jesus Christ is a preview of your new consciousness. In your consciousness of truth, right this instant, not tomorrow, but this instant, the fact is revealed that your spiritual self is now walking on the water. You might catch up with yourself eventually to realize that, but it is a fact now. The Christ of each of us is walking on water, which means it has overcome the first birth. If you go back to John the Baptist, you will see that he is a symbol of the first birth. I, he said, must decrease. And he who follows me, whose shoe latchet I am not worthy to unloose, he must increase. The second birth. The material man, the spiritual man. And then John, the symbol of the first birth, is also the symbol of water. And so he baptizes with water. He even baptizes Jesus with water. But it isn't long before there's an inner baptism of the Spirit. And then we see the meaning of baptism with water and baptism with fire. The second baptism, the baptism of fire, is the baptism of light upon the water. And we see many, many other symbols. We see water as a symbol of mortality. Water as a symbol of the human birth. Each of us comes into this mortal sphere the same way. Actually come out of a water bag. And this is the baptism of the water. And now we must be reborn of the water and the Spirit. Now the early Christians were in their first birth. And so they were called little fish. And these little fish were in the water. But they were really trapped in the water. They had to learn to come out of the water. And now we find this spectacle of the man called Jesus Christ walking on the water, which means he had risen from the first birth of water. He was no longer trapped within the water, but he was now standing on the water. He had come out of the little fish stage. He had come into the rebirth. The resurrected self, to whom water is no longer an obstruction, an obstacle, something that can drown you, but rather a harmonious expression of the oneself. And so the symbolism of the water and standing on the water, walking on the water, is mortality being dissolved into immortality. It is a symbol of the new age of rebirth. All who come into the conscious awareness of the indwelling Christ are walking upon the water, dissolving mortality into the illuminated consciousness of immortality. And this is the now fact. Never is there a physical form that walks upon the water. You will not physically walk upon the water. Jesus did not physically walk upon the water. No one, anywhere, at any time in a human form, will walk upon the water on this earth. Now let's take him for what he said. I am the light. You have seen light shine upon water. Does it drown? Does it go under? It's right there on top. I am the light. I am the water. I am the wine. Always the knowledge that light is the substance of his being, and light is the substance of all that we call matter. And there's light upon light, not form of man upon physical water. Consciousness, one with itself, externalizes. Always, that which is in consciousness is made visible. You're not seeing a physical form walk upon physical water. You're seeing the infinite consciousness made visible as one harmonious activity of two different kinds of form. You're seeing a third dimensional form called ocean or lake or water, and a fourth dimensional form called spiritual body. A fourth dimensional body of the soul, made of light, appearing where there is a three dimensional concept called water, and they appear to be in contact. But it is the consciousness of one being made visibly manifest. The consciousness of the Christ. Peter wants to do that. Just as anyone would want to do that. And the mistake, of course, is that this is an external event. That there is someone doing it. And no one is doing it in the outer. The activity is all taking place within the consciousness. And unless there is an inner activity, it cannot be made visible as form walking on water. Peter, not knowing this, thinking you can just go and do it, wants to do it, but he hasn't had the inner activity. Peter is still a man. Jesus is the Spirit. Peter is still the mortal being. Jesus is the immortal self. Now for you and for me, the message of walking on the water contains within itself all that we have to know about ourselves, our identity, what we're doing here and why and how we ought to do it. Now let us see, without flinching from fact, that if water is what science tells us it is, and if the physical form of Jesus was what science tells us it was, that there could have been no walking on the water. And therefore, if it happened, as it is reported here, then it broke all of the material laws of science. And naturally, science would be outraged because it cannot acknowledge this as a fact, because it cannot explain how he could shatter every material law. What is science going to do now? Once it acknowledges this as a fact, it cannot explain its material laws anymore. The law of gravity was broken. You didn't pick up the morning paper and see that somebody walked on water. You don't expect to. Science doesn't expect to. But here somebody did. And there's no explanation scientifically. There's no explanation religiously, except God did something supernatural. But there is a scientific explanation. And it is shattering, but not to those who dwell in identity. If we take science's word that man is formed of the atom, and the water is formed of the atom, then scientifically what you have is atoms walking upon atoms. But we know that there are atoms that would fall through that lake and drown. We know that when Peter tried it, he almost drowned, except that Jesus reached out to grab him. We know that the boat they were in, which is human safety, or the symbol of it, was not safety for them at all. We know that everything there is a symbol. These are all props to teach us something. There's water. And there's a ship, which is a symbol of safety. And there's a shore that they're rowing toward. And yet all of these things, the oars, the symbol of safety called the boat, are helpless in the face of material law called wind and raising water. And yet something comes along with no props to help it and saves them. We are being shown that the external belief in the power of matter to help us is a sham. There is no external help. And the help comes not from something external. It comes from the inner consciousness of one who is sitting on a mountaintop miles away. That's where the help comes from, not from the boat or the oars. And then suddenly there's no wind. And suddenly there are still waters. And gradually we begin to conceive within ourselves what really happened. What we are learning is that the complete outer picture was first a series of mental images in the minds of the disciples who were rowing upon the lake. Not hallucinations, not visions, fact as we see it today, but revealed by the Master as a cosmic hallucination. Not just that storm on that day in that sea, but every storm on every day in every sea is revealed as much a cosmic hallucination as that one. And the same power that sent a form called Christ moving across the water then is here to do the same for every storm at sea today. If you believe on me, the works that I do, ye shall do. And this is the challenge, that there is a Christ form to move out and walk across every sea and every ocean into every part of the universe where there is a storm, where there is a turbulence, where there is a wind, where there is a whirlwind, where there are men frightened by the elements, where there is a witness of the omnipresent Spirit as the only living presence. And there was one who had just fed the multitudes, and that one, without any visible support, defied the laws of space, of time, and of matter, and of motion. Defied everything that science has drawn around us as a fact. And without a word of explanation, demonstrated that time is not what we think, space is not what we think, matter is not what we think, material form is not what we think, and material condition is not what we think. In fact, none of them have any power in the presence of that Spirit which walked out upon the sea, clambered upon the ship, and instantly took it to the shore. What had happened to change the complete picture? The law of externalization. The unilluminated consciousness outpictured one scene, which we have learned to call cosmic television, And the illuminated consciousness outpictured another scene, which we have called infinite mind television. That is what happened. Two different scenes. But I, if I be lifted up, take you out of the cosmic mind scene into the infinite mind reality of perfection. And so demonstrated there that day on that sea was that matter is a mental image. Whether it's a calm sea or a turbulent one, that a ship is a mental image. That the conditions of a ship on a windswept sea are all one mental image. That all material form is a mental image, including the person. And the hard teaching was that man is spirit. And just as man is spirit and not physical form, the ocean is spirit and not hydrogen and oxygen. And wood is spirit, not wood. But science says it's all made of atoms. And there was one picture of atoms changed by the master to another picture. And so if we accept the atomic structure of things, how could he change it? You see, this too blasts the atomic theory. And science is left completely without any theory at all, just dumbfounded. There's nothing it can say except show us how to do it. Or it never happened. Now, while science says it never happened, and religion not knowing why or how it happened, we are left without a God. We are left without spiritual power. We are left at the mercy of a cosmic mind and consequently in a state of cosmic hypnotism. We are left in a situation where a boy comes home from war, and whereas before he went to war, he was, as his father called him, perfect. In today's paper, the comedian, Jerry Lewis, he doesn't think war is very funny. He had a boy who was a perfect boy. A rock band leader. Everything about the boy was just the way a father wanted him to be. One thing got in the way. He was drafted. And when he came back, instead of this vivacious, alert, eager, enthusiastic boy, there was someone who not only couldn't adjust, but didn't care. His father would say to him, "You've got to put your head back on your shoulders." And he'd say, "Well, why?" He had seen something. He had seen a futility, a helplessness, a purposelessness called war, in which nobody wins. This is cosmic mind. You take away the incident of walking on water and you're stuck with that cosmic mind which outpictures war. You take away the incident of walking on water and you're stuck with this world. What's the answer to it? Well, this comedian, Jerry Lewis, has an answer to it. It's running away. He says, "They won't get another one of my sons." He says, "I've got one now who's 15 and a half. If this war is still on in 2.5 years, there's going to be a beacon's truck pull up in front of my house, and we're all getting in it. And we're going straight out to the water, and we won't stop." Now, you see, there's a better way. We can't all get into a beacon's truck. We only do that when we do not understand identity. The spirit of you walked upon the water that day. The spirit of Jesus and the spirit of you and the spirit of me are one and the same. And the spirit said, "Be not afraid, it is I. I, the spirit. And where I am, there is no storm." You're looking at an illusion. What were you worried about? Where was your faith in the identity of your being? The Spirit said to them, "Am I not the only power? Have I not been telling you that I in the midst of you am mighty? Have I not been telling you that I am the activity of God in you? And that I am not material? I am pure light. I am the substance of infinity. I can never leave you. Right here out on the sea, I am. And that sea that you're looking at, it is I. Be not afraid, it is I. All that is here is I. I am the sea, I am the water. I am the ship. I am the individuality of each one of you frantically rowing away. I am the only. I am the one. I am the omnipresent spirit, and beside me there is no other. Of course I walk upon the water. I always walk upon the water. I'm not walking on the water any different than I walked upon the land. It's just that when I walked upon the land that you did not notice that I wasn't walking like others. If he hadn't walked upon water, they would never have known that he was walking the same way on the land. There is no obstacle or obstruction to I, the Spirit. I, the Spirit, lives in an unobstructed universe. I, the Spirit, walk through steel. I, the Spirit, walk through walls of concrete. Why? Because light is like the X-ray. Doesn't the X-ray show certain things that you cannot see with human eyes? The X-ray itself is but a counterfeit imitation of I, the life, the Spirit, the essence. And so one standing in identity overcomes a whole sea, a sea of illusion. Is it any different than a common cold or a backache? I walk upon the water, walk where every germ seems to be, where every ache seems to be, where every bit of suffering seems to be. It is only I. Be not afraid. And they followed him after this. They still didn't know, and they thought he was now surely going to free the Hebrew nation. So he had to make it still clearer, although he knew nothing would except disappearing from the tomb. He had to make it clear what he was teaching, that matter does not exist. It does not exist. There was no sea there. There was no ship there. There was only the invisible God there. Only the Spirit. Where each of us stand is the Spirit. And if it's a room instead of an ocean, nothing has changed. No appearance changes the fact of reality. Your chapter in Contemplative Life was Contemplation Develops the Beholder. And contemplation, it turns out to be, is not pondering. It's not sitting there in deep thought. Contemplation is that capacity to behold all appearances, lakes, mountains, storms, tranquility, and as Joel puts it, to watch them all as you would a sunrise or as you would a painting. You don't get out your brush, you watch it. You don't go out there and push the sun up and down, you watch it. You behold. And then in contemplation, you not only behold, but you develop the capacity to let God within, I, the Spirit, interpret my universe to you. As you dwell in the silence of contemplation, beholding, as you would behold a sunrise, only in that stillness of beholding are you opening the mind to let truth emerge, interpreting itself, free and independent of the five sense interpretation. The five sense kingdom of this world showed arising a raging sea. But the beholder, standing in the contemplation of that raging sea, letting the invisible self interpret itself, discovers that the sea ceases to rage. The wind ceases to storm. And even time stands still. And space diminishes into nothingness, and they stand now on the shore. Because in God there is no space and no time, and no whirlwind, no raging sea. If you believe on me, the works I do you shall do. Which means that this was not an event for one, but that the consciousness which can behold the raging sea and the whirlwind, which can step out of time and space, is part of the property of all who are joint heirs in Christ. You and I, as we develop the capacity to withhold judgment, not saying this is bad and this is good, but just to behold and to let the inner spirit interpret to us, discover the law of grace is functioning. Often someone says, why shouldn't I call something good? Because the moment you designate it as good, you only do so because it's better in your eye than something which you didn't designate good. And therefore you have fallen into the trap of something that is good and something that, by your unwillingness to designate it as good, means that you think it's bad. And so you've got a duality, a double consciousness. You've got the belief that there's a good and a bad. When you magnify that, you'll find it's the difference between a sea that is calm and a sea that is turbulent. Always, the outer expresses the inner. Matter is not there. Matter is a mental image. Therefore, what's in your mind becomes more important than what's out there. And as the world tries to conquer matter, what is it conquering? A mental image. And so we're told, withhold your judgment. Don't conquer the world. Don't conquer matter. Don't seek a victory over the things of the world. If you must seek a victory, realize that the outer world is nothing but the expression of mind. And therefore, let's get back to mind. And then if you want to go further still, the mind that outpictures evil isn't the mind of God. Why try to conquer it? Don't conquer matter and don't conquer mind. Conquer nothing. Be still. To know that mind and matter are not of God is your victory. To look at that which mind and matter conspire to produce and to know it isn't there, this is the beholding. This is the contemplative life. To look at all material things, conditions, objects, persons, with no judgment that it is good or bad. This is the contemplative way. It's a self-denial. And many people aren't happy unless they can spend their hours telling you about someone else who has done a foolish thing, or someone else who is stupid, or someone else who is wicked. Always the discussion takes the turn of the third party who isn't there. And we all know that third party who isn't there is either foolish or stupid or a cheat. And this becomes the way of conversation among mortal beings, never realizing that we are judging ourselves. We are falling into the trap of a consciousness which is dual. All mental concept, whether it's good or bad, is a trap. When you say Margie is good, you're saying someone else isn't. Always the subtle implication that this one is better than that one is falling into the trap of materiality. And the hard teaching, the teaching that enables you to walk upon the water of spirit, is that materiality does not exist. It can neither be good nor bad. And every time you violate it, you'll find that the teaching of walking upon the water has eluded you. Now then, contemplation, the withdrawal of judgment, the awareness that only spirit is present, would seem to leave you with nowhere to go. You remove all of the material world, and there's nothing left. Seems like a stalemate, a blind corner. And where do you go from there? Unfortunately, you'll never know until you get to that point. Those are the terms. And that's why it's a hard teaching. The price you pay is complete annihilation of the belief in matter. And then you don't seek matter. You don't strive to win or earn matter. You don't struggle to possess matter or to hold matter. You don't love matter. You don't hate matter. You don't fear matter. You're making your transition to where you are coming out of the birth in water as mortal being, out of the fish trapped in the tomb of a natural birth in matter. And now you're leaping above the water, above the material world, above mortality, above every concept of the past, above every concept of the world, into my kingdom, which is not of this world, but is here. And when you are willing to walk upon the water, which means to erase the concept of matter in your consciousness, then You are coming into your transitional experience in which the keys to the kingdom are given to you, and that which has been invisible is opened up. There were two steps in the work of Jesus. The first was always to bring harmony. He didn't take them into the invisible spiritual universe. He brought material harmony first. In other words, he first obeyed the law of normalcy in this world. He took it out of the abnormal situation into the normal rhythm of goodness. And having brought harmony, he then was able to take it from sense to soul. Now, all of us have sought the harmony without taking the next step from sense to soul. And you know how many people drop out of this work when the harmony comes. But it always becomes discord later again because they have not been willing to erase the fullness of the belief in matter. They've been willing to postpone their belief in matter just for a moment to lose the problem. But they don't walk upon the water. Now, as you behold all material worlds, all material objects, all material things in your non-reactive acceptance that the invisible spirit alone is present as my identity, the identity of the water, of all who are here, in this quiet contemplation, you have opened the way for truth, and the truth is what quickens you. It quickens you out of death. Matter and death are one and the same. Out of mortality. And that quickening breaks the law of the atom, the law of karma. That quickening puts science right back in a cage. That quickening breaks every physical law, because that quickening is what changes the images. He leadeth us to still waters. Cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils. Recognize the spiritual identity. Every disciple had forgotten that I and the Father are one, and I can never leave you. The Spirit quickeneth. And for that reason, Paul could say, in spite of all the infirmities that besiege me, I am not moved by them. He was a contemplative. Now you know that Jesus didn't behold this scene in one instant and become a contemplative. This is part of the discipline. We are those disciples rowing on the turbulent sea. Each of us has his own turbulent sea. Each of us is struggling frantically to overcome it, and it isn't there. The hypnosis is that it is there, that we are in a form, and that the material world to us is a turbulent sea, and each day we're struggling to overcome part of it, to build a little place where we can call our sanctuary, our peace table, to put up a little nest egg, to maintain our health. If you walk upon the water of spirit, you'll stop all of that. Identity tells you you are spirit, and only spirit. Are you trying to maintain the health of spirit? or isn't trying to maintain your health a denial of spiritual identity? You're putting up a nest egg. Is spirit requiring a nest egg? No, that's a human mind doing it, isn't it? Start to think about all of the things you're doing mentally, physically, to deny your spiritual identity and see what is stopping you from walking upon the water of spirit. How in one grand recognition of the spiritual nature of the universe, we know that all matter comes under subjection. For there, walking in defiance of gravity on water that can never hold a solid man, in a windstorm, on a rising sea, all is suddenly peaceful and calm. All of the material world on one lake is brought under the dominion of one invisible recognition of spiritual identity as the only. Every heartbeat, every backache, every pain, every lack, every limitation is taken care of in that 1 second of spiritual identity as mine and yours, as a universal fact. Nothing left to do. The hypnosis is broken. And we discover that atoms, which allegedly are the substance of matter, which can be fashioned into a bomb, atoms are not there. Atoms are images in the mind, just as matter itself is an image in the mind. We never drop a bomb, we drop images. Those same atoms, which in matter cause what we call decay, degeneration, they are not present in the presence of I, the Spirit. All of the power of matter is built upon the existence of matter. And here the Spirit proves the non-existence of matter and thereby the non-power of the matter, which has no existence. Matter is built upon the atom. And the Spirit proves that there are no atoms. The power of matter, matter built upon the atom, all are nothingness in the illuminated consciousness of the Christ. There is no atomic world, no material world, no material power in the world. There is only my Spirit. And that covers every ache and pain and lack and limitation in the world. And then when religion says it happened, but has no meaning for it, and science says it didn't happen, we are deprived of one of the greatest demonstrations of enlightenment, which explains the passage in Genesis that man was given dominion. Spiritual man was given dominion. And your dominion lies then over land and over sea and over air, because there is no land and there is no sea and there is no air. And your dominion over them is because they are non-existent. Only I, the invisible Spirit, exist. And that is the difficulty of that teaching of walking on water. They prove the non-existence of the water, of the material world, and of the conditions in the material world. And we, who are trying to live in identity, discover that this is true. whenever there is an inner awakening, when the identity speaks, when in the stillness the voice utters itself, the sea of the world is melted, the earth is melted, the problem is melted. There is something that bubbles up and bursts within. And in that quickening, in my peace, we are literally walking on the water. You don't see Christ walking on the water, but the infinite is walking throughout itself on the waters of spirit, revealing the perfect presence that is ever here. In identity, you never waver between doubt and faith. You don't pray and doubt at the same time. In identity, perfection is the law of being. Any imperfection is rejected because it denies identity. And identity never changes. Identity is always identity. Spiritual selfhood is always spiritual selfhood. And everything that declares something is wrong is telling you you're not spiritual selfhood. And so you're not trying to make anything better. You're trying to recognize the hypnotism of what isn't there. The hypnotism of the rising sea. Now, it may seem difficult to the rest of the world to try to understand that a sea isn't there, a boat isn't there, a person isn't there, only God is, only spirit is, only identity is. But 10,000 healings by Jesus and 20,000 by Buddha and 10,000 by Joel and 5 or 10 by you and me is enough to tell us